The North Carolina Reading Service brings you the following program for our blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week. I'm John Feddersen to read this week's edition to you. The first broadcast for May the 9th of 2024. And as I mentioned, it's intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Indie Week, here we go. One of Indie Week's continuing article focuses is on, of course, housing in the Triangle area. And that's not surprising. We have a couple of articles related to that. First article published on April the 24th from Raleigh about a nonprofit raising money for its first cottage court. Lavelle Moton is a staple of Southeast Raleigh's Idlewild community, one of the first neighborhoods in the city in which former slaves were permitted to buy homes. The acclaimed head coach of NC Central University's men's basketball team was raised there in the housing projects with a single mother, Hattie McDougald. And in 2022, the neighborhood park was named in Moton's honor. Now, Moton and Idlewilds are both making history again for a new, innovative development that seeks to address the economic and systemic issues of home ownership and renting for those traditionally shut out. Earlier this month, the nonprofit Raleigh Area Land Trust, RALT, announced it had secured $8.3 million to provide affordable housing in Idlewild. Moton is also one of the leaders and partners of development of the new project through his company, Raleigh Raised Development, RRD, along with Haven Design Build. Moton said of this project during a city council meeting in February, "We have an opportunity to eradicate generational poverty." The project, planned for a vacant lot and named the Cottages of Idlewild, has been in the works since 2020 and is slated to be completed by 2025. Various community partners and donors, including the City of Raleigh, provided financial support for Raleigh's first affordable cottage court, and it will be the first of its kind to provide permanent affordable homeownership for the first-time home buyers in Wake County. The project is incredibly personal to Moton, who lived on Jones Street growing up. He recounted to the council, "My grandmother lived on Lane Street. My great-grandmother lived on Idlewild. That was three generations of intergenerational poverty, and 40 years of that housing project existed." Needless to say, homeownership is super important. In the 60s, 63, I believe, when Dr. King marched on Washington, the premise of that march was for jobs, justice, and home ownership. Idlewild's median income today is half Wake County's average. Only 35% of residents in and around Idlewild are homeowners, compared to 69% in Wake County overall. According to the nonprofit trade association NC Realtors, the median home sale price in North Carolina, the state, surged to over $300,000 in the fourth quarter last year, up from $200,000 in April of 2020. This 37% increase underscores the urgency of addressing housing affordability, particularly in Wake County. For low to moderate income families, the project is designed to be a shared equity model for homeownership and affordability across generations, offering long-term stability for families and communities alike. It will have 18 affordable homes and rental opportunities for individuals and families making 50 to 80% of the area median income, the AMI. The cottage court model will have a central court, enhancing community connectivity, and inclusivity and featuring art and other community installations. The design will work in unison with the Community Land Trust Homeownership Model, CLT, Homeownership Model, with the needs unaffected by market pressures. RALT will maintain the land ownership while each resident owns or rents the homes. Because of this, the purchase price of the home is lower, allowing those with lower incomes to qualify. With the harmful effects of gentrification and redlining, the project is an example of investing in communities to build generational wealth compared to displacement and limiting growth opportunities, especially for minorities. Kevin Campbell, Executive Director of Raleigh Area Land Trust, is excited about the development and its potential impact on the community, and he says, "It's all about leveling the playing field when it comes to ownership. With the cottages, we're not just building houses, we're building futures by lowering the barrier of entry to homeownership through affordable purchase prices." Campbell says he's proud of the supporters of the project, which include the NC Realtors Housing Foundation, Wells Fargo Foundation, and Coastal Credit Union Foundation, amongst others. And he says this funding represents a significant milestone for RALT and underscores our unwavering commitment to addressing the pressing issue of affordable housing in Wake County. With the support of our partners and donors, we are confident in our ability to make a tangible difference in meeting the housing needs of our community. Now, in addition, RALT homebuyers will gain access to down payment assistance programs, stability through a predictable monthly mortgage, and tax savings benefits. At the city council meeting, Moton stressed the importance of going back to his community and giving back after the support it gave him. Quote, "It's not only a moral obligation, but a social responsibility for me to come here and act on behalf of other people who have similar situations that couldn't shoot a basketball as well as me, but they supported me." Now, the article in Indie Week gives a website for RALT, but the site itself is not listed. RALT is the Raleigh Area Land Trust. So anyone interested could go to that website and look it up. And additionally, though, information sessions have begun for those interested in residing at the cottages of Idlewild, along with the qualifications. So I'm sure that RALT's website will list all of those or ways that you can find them out if you're interested in this residence. This is an exciting prospect, particularly, I say, if it's going to be completed in just 2 years. We'll see. I know that street pretty well, living a few blocks from there for a good while myself. Now, next, Greg Childress has written a longer article, again concerning black homeowners in southeast Raleigh. On a near perfect spring afternoon, a crowd of mostly black retirees and senior citizens poured into Martin Street Baptist Church in southeast Raleigh to learn about strategies to lower property taxes through Wake County's appeals process. In their neighborhoods, higher property values have brought higher property taxes. That, in turn, has made it difficult for residents on fixed incomes to make ends meet. Lemuel Sherman traveled across town from the city's west side with his wife, Barbara. Quote, "To see if there's an opportunity for property tax reduction," he says, when asked what brought him. "The fact that they go up every 4 years, regardless, for seniors and non-working people, there's no moratorium or way to stop that every 4 year increase." The Shermans were typical of the residents who attended the workshop led by Wake County Property Tax Working Group, which called a meeting to offer residents an opportunity to appeal property taxes they believe are unfair. And that workshop came just weeks before the May 15th deadline to appeal. And that means just within a week. to appeal tax appraisals in the state of North Carolina, May 15th. The working group is made up of community members and organizations that include Men of Southeast Raleigh, Raleigh Village East, and the Biltmore Hills Neighborhood Association, with support from the Housing Coalition. It was widely reported in January that Wake County property values increased by 56% between 2020 and 2024, which is the county's most recent four-year revaluation cycle. It is the largest such increase ever recorded. Higher valuation and the ensuing higher taxes in the historically black neighborhoods, particularly those near downtown, facing development pressure from investors, are raising tough questions about what some residents believe is a systemically flawed method to value property. In some cases, long-time residents in smaller homes pay more in taxes because their property carries a higher value than nearby new and larger homes which sell for more. And what's happening in Raleigh is not unusual. Across the country, homes in black neighborhoods are often underappraised for sale or refinancing, but then overassessed for property tax purposes. Hudson Vaughn works for the North Carolina Housing Coalition Community Justice Collaborative. That's a project that supports historically black communities in these fights against displacement and gentrification. And they say, what often happens is the older homes, especially smaller, get overvalued. They get pushed up and they end up being overassessed and paying more of the burden of property taxes. Racism is often cited as the cause when homes in black neighborhoods are underappraised for sale or refinancing. And Vaughn says, nationwide, when you have your home appraised for bank purposes or to get a loan, there's been so much documentation of black people whose appraisal comes back and the home is way underappraised. If they take down the pictures in their house and make it a white family to pose, they get a higher appraisal value. A 2022 report by the Brookings Institution using FHA, Federal Finance Agency data, found black neighborhoods are valued 21 to 23% below what their valuations would be in non-black neighborhoods. It estimates the cost of devaluation across the 113 metro areas in the U.S. with at least one majority black neighborhood is approximately $162 billion. Vaughn, who is white, knows about the inequities rendered by the property valuation process. In the historically black North Side neighborhood in Chapel Hill, where he lives, his advocacy work uncovered substantial tax inequities between long-term black residents and wealthy investors who were developing large student rental properties in the neighborhood. The homes of North Side's 100 longest-term black residents had been so severely overassessed that successful appeals reduced their property taxes by $500,000 collectively. Meanwhile, Vaughn says investors nearby had been significantly underassessed so much that when he appealed their valuations, the investors began to see $1,000 and $2,000 increases in their valuations. Vaughn brought receipts from Chapel Hill, sharing information with residents that showed a black-owned 2,200-square-foot three-bedroom home built in 1945 being appraised for tax value at $425,800, while a 3,400-square-foot six-bedroom investor-owned student rental in the same neighborhood was appraised at $418,100. Let's hear that again. A six-bedroom at $418,000, a three-bedroom built in 1945, $425,000. Sounds like more to me. Similar inequities are occurring in Raleigh and across the state, says Vaughn. there were definitely some folks who we suggested didn't have a strong case based on comparable sales, but there are a lot of folks planning to proceed with appeals. He said it was referring to workshop participants. Vaughn cited another strong example of inequity on East Harget Street in Raleigh, where a 1,700 square foot home is assessed at $750,000, even though the comparable sales of newer homes around it sold in the $500,000 to $600,000 range. And he says, in fact, the only homes that sold for over $700,000 were right across the street, and they were three-story modern houses that all sold for $800,000 but were valued in the $700,000s, just like the owner of this one. So her house, based on comparable sales, is $200,000 to $250,000 overvalued. In addition, a house down the street from that home is valued at $600,000, Vaughn says, but sold for $650,000. It's been completely renovated and is larger, but was appraised for $100,000 less. He acknowledged, though, that the East Harget Street valuation is not typical. What is more typical in neighborhoods like the city's South Park, College Park, and others near downtown is the overvaluation of smaller, older homes by $50,000 to $100,000. The amount depends on the condition of the homes, land inflation, and other factors. Anthony Pope, who leads the Men of Southeast Raleigh, lives in a small stone front house on South Swain Street that his mother purchased in the mid-1980s for about $48,000. He says his mother paid about $400 in property taxes in 1986. Taxes have steadily increased, he says, since he moved into the house in 2010 after his mother's death. So it was $400 in 1986. He is now paying nearly $4,000 per year in taxes and says, I haven't done anything to the house since I renovated the inside when I bought it. The tax increases are the direct result of several expensive new housing developments that have sprouted up around him, he says, which include several townhouses with asking prices of more than $1 million. And Pope says, that's happening not only on my street, but all over Southeast Raleigh. These developers are coming in, buying up property, and we being forced or taxed out because the taxes have gotten so high that people cannot afford to pay them. Vaughn concluded in a recent study, this study entitled, Are North Carolina Property Taxes Fair and Equitable? The property valuations in the north side, a community where he lives, were not the result of purposeful discrimination, individual mistake, or assessment malpractice, but instead a systemic error following an approach to mass assessment common across the country that lends itself to inequity. He wrote the county had, in fact, met basic sales ratio requirements and matched neighborhood averages to qualified comparable sales, but things had still somehow gone awry. And he said there was not one easily identified problem, but several issues came to light in this process. And here are these issues. Attention has not been paid to variations of the neighborhood's zoning restrictions and limitations. Houses built in the 1920s without major renovations were being compared to much bigger homes built or renovated in the last 20 years. Neighborhood delineations, which help determine land values, combined disparate property ages and types and yet divided the community in ways that separated off relevant sales that showed the range of the housing market. As a result, land values had been set for properties at higher amounts than some of the neighborhood's home sales, even those in which the property value was clearly more than just the land itself. Next, data on many homes was inaccurate, especially on investor homes, featuring work completed without permits. And finally, averages and medians had been overutilized, squeezing assessed values to the middle. There were fewer appeals from residents of low-wealth, historically black neighborhoods, which might have contributed to the lack of recognition to the detailed differences within the community. And Vaughn said property tax inequities can be traced to the systems used to place values on property. It's absolutely a problem with the tools itself, and I think that's really been clear. It's not like a bad actor in the system. I mean, there probably are people who do it more deliberately, but in my experience, especially in counties like Wake, they actually do a lot that's progressive in how they try to do the assessment well. Now, Vaughn recommends the state increase the Department of Revenue's ability to conduct oversight and accountability over county property taxation and reduce the number of years between revaluations. Some counties conduct them every 8 years. The housing market, he said, changes a lot over the course of 8 years, even in rural counties. Infrequent reassessments tend to benefit property owners with rapidly rising values as their market values rise each year, while their assessed value remains the same until a reassessment year. Meanwhile, property owners with more stagnant values end up carrying the heavier burden of taxes. It should not be a surprise that this heavier burden most often falls on lower income and minority communities. All right, to Durham, story with timers. Story of May 6th, leaking roofs, broken HVACs. Conditions at Durham Elementary Schools are decried. When Teresa Blackington enrolled her kindergartner at Club Boulevard Elementary, she worried about the maintenance of the school's nearly 75-year-old campus. School administration assured her that renovations would begin within the year, she says. I wasn't looking for anything cosmetic. I just wanted the school to be functional. Next year, Dowell Blackington's daughter will graduate from Club Boulevard. It's been 5 years. And fixes, electrical repairs, and other renovations still are not complete. Dowell Blackington says the plumbing in the bathrooms is constantly broken and water pressure in the school water fountains is so low that students can't fill water bottles. She says if they forget their bottles, they're out of luck. But these are hardly Dowell Blackington's biggest concerns. She says, my daughter in fourth grade, her classroom was never under 80 degrees the entire school year. They'd invite parents in for a school activity, and it was unbearable. To cool down classrooms, Dowell Blackington says the school installed box fans, but they were so loud that teachers began teaching into microphones and speakers. She says they just can't learn if they're so hot and uncomfortable. You've got your hierarchy of basic needs. If you're not meeting those needs, you can't expect kids to perform at their best. Club Boulevard Elementary is not the only school in Durham awaiting overdue renovations. Parents at aging elementary schools across the district are growing frustrated with a lack of maintenance. And at some schools, inspections have found evidence of mold. And parents worry that the district is moving too slowly to eliminate it. In 2022, voters approved a $400 million bond referendum for construction and renovations of Durham Public Schools, DPS. That money was supposed to cover construction and renovation at 8 Durham schools. However, the construction of 2 new public schools proved far more expensive than originally planned. The district spent nearly $91 million to build Murray Massenburg Elementary. The budget for construction of a new Durham School of the Arts campus, meanwhile, has nearly doubled to $241 million. As a result, renovations at 4 Durham Elementaries, Club, Moorhead, Bethesda, and Mangum, have been postponed. Meanwhile, the timeline is unclear for renovating other aging Durham elementary schools that are listed on the district's 10-year capital improvement plan. Bettina Umstead, chair of the Board of Education, says the new campuses are necessary to address overcrowding. Murray Messenberg has won various awards, and Frederick Davis, the school system's senior executive director of building services, have called the campus the Cadillac of schools. But parents at some of the district's aging elementary say their schools have been abandoned. Lauren Sartain, the mother of two students at E.K. Powell Elementary, says their school has been dealing with roof leaks, dilapidated outdoor equipment, and broken air conditioning. Powell is included on the district's 10-year capital improvement plan, but the district has not shared a timeline for renovation. Last April, Sartain's son tripped on the school's torn-up AstroTurf and knocked out his two front teeth. When the accident happened, Sartain says she had been asking for playground repairs for 5 years and been assured that renovations were forthcoming, and says, when you have 60 first graders on the small playground with torn-up turf, it's a safety issue. She's contacted school board members multiple times and spoken at meetings, but feels her activism has fallen on deaf ears. In a work session on March 7th, Davis delivered a status report on recent renovations. Afterward, board member Jessica Carter-Outen had a question. She said, what are the implications of not completing the renovations in the next few years to the deferred schools? Are we looking at unsafe or inadequate learning conditions? Davis replied, our maintenance and facilities department has done an excellent job of maintaining buildings that have fully exceeded their life expectancy. But Sartain questions Davis's claim. It seems like they'll tell people what they want to hear, but then nothing ever ends up happening. It's gotten exhausting, like we're screaming into a void. We're not patching the roof. We're not fixing the HVAC. We're not doing this basic day-to-day stuff. Umstead, the school board chair, acknowledges that parents are upset. She says, I know there's been a lot of frustration around building conditions, and we are working really diligently on those issues, saying the issue boils down to underfunding. Umstead says, Durham Public Schools, we try to make the most of our capital dollars we've received from the county. The DPS is doing our best, and we know we don't have enough to manage every single building in the way we probably should. It's not just playgrounds and broken water fountains that worry parents. At E.K. Powell, parents fear that leaks and high temperatures are contributing to mold growth. Mold is exacerbated by high temperatures, elevated humidity, and water leaks. Sartain says water is constantly leaking into Powell classrooms. She says leaking is a kind way to describe it. The custodial staff has to go in multiple times a day to mop the classrooms. According to Sartain, the HVAC system at Powell has been broken for nearly a month, and temperatures in many classrooms have neared 90 degrees. She says she was told the system will only be repaired in classrooms where students are taking end-of-grade tests. A limited mold assessment at Powell in July of 2023, conducted by SNME, that's an engineering consulting firm, observed water damage on the ceiling, bubbling paint, and visible water intrusion. That report found trace amounts of mold with allergenic potential and mycotoxin potential in hallways and classrooms, findings the report called significant. The report recommended that Powell remove discolored tiles, repair the leaking roof, and have a qualified mold remediation contractor remove drywall in various classrooms. The Durham County Department of Public Health also conducted an annual inspection at the school in October of 2023 that found water damage and roof leaks. The department, however, has little enforcement authority, and does not issue fines or penalties. Laura Lurch, the General Inspection Supervisor, says, all we do is take this report and then we send it to the school principal. Then it's in their hands to work with the school system to get these repairs. E.K. Powell administration did not respond to requests for comments. Parents report the roof is still leaking. Chris Hevener, the parent of a first grader and rising kindergartner at E.K. Powell, contacted DPS board members and the Durham County Board of Commissioners with concerns requesting a mold remediation plan and timeline. I'm requesting, he wrote in an email, that you address this urgent issue. The well-being of our children and staff necessitates transparency. He says he received no reply. Anna Simmons, mother of a second grader at E.K. Powell, is also worried about mold and says that her daughter's pre-existing health conditions have been worsened by building conditions. She has contacted the school principal, PTA, the Durham County Department of Public Health, DPS Interim Superintendent, the Board of Education, and the County Board of Commissioners, requesting an in-depth investigation and remediation plan. Simmons says they keep saying, we have quotes, but when are you going to do it? I'm a taxpayer, I'm a voter, and I want a timeline and a full investigation. All kids and educators and everyone in that building should be able to go into a healthy environment. Simmons and Sartain feel the burden of advocacy has fallen into their hands, but most parents have busy schedules and little time to spare. Sartain says, teachers and other parents don't have the bandwidth to do this, and honestly, none of us should have to do this. In a statement, Clifton Williams, Facilities and Operations Director, and Davis, the Senior Executive Director of Building Services, said the school district monitors school air quality and is working to improve it. The statement said, quote, over the last 2 years, the district has spent more than $15 million on indoor air quality. Our efforts will continue to help reduce sick days, remove mold risk, mitigate asthma and allergy triggers, reduce energy costs, and even improve test scores. Meanwhile, Hevener worries about the example of Alamance Burlington School District, where last August mold was discovered in at least 30 of 36 of their schools. Toxigenic mold was found in 16 of these, which inspectors say was a result of invasive water damage over time. Alamance Burlington was forced to delay their school's start date by 2 weeks and spend $25 million to remediate buildings, triggering a budget crisis. Les Atkins, the former public information officer for Alamance Burlington District, said in an interview, this is years and years of underfunding for certain projects. What we found was that some small things that maybe had been left unattended to were big things. That little bit of water intrusion we were alerted to at some point, now it's turned into toxigenic mold behind the wall. At DPS board meetings, parents have repeatedly spoken about their rundown elementary schools. The school board recently approved, this is in Durham, hired a consulting firm, Turner and Townsend Heary, to assess building deficiencies. That contract for $1.5 million includes $500,000 in community engagement workshops. In a joint meeting with DPS and the Board of Commissioners, Frederick Davis also described a school system subcommittee that recommends how to allocate renovation funds. When asked if parents are included in the advisory committee, Davis replied, no. He says, I'm inundated with parents that say, my school next, my school next. We're trying to make sure that we're equitable and equal. To Lauren Sartain, this comment was a slap in the face. I'm not asking for nice things or a new building. I'm just asking not to have water pouring into classrooms, she says. Teresa Blackington agrees. She says she's not looking for extra bells and whistles. I want my kid to fill a water bottle and have a bathroom and classroom at a reasonable temperature. She says, you see in the paper the new opening of Murray Massenburg and all these schools that are just beautiful. I wish every school could be like that. It's hard to swallow, especially because the district's favorite word is equity, and that seems highly inequitable. And finally, this article concludes with a statement from Clifton Williams, the Facilities and Operations Director, and Frederick Davis, Senior Executive Director of Building Services. Quote, Durham Public Schools continues to monitor indoor air quality in schools and have added CO2 sensors in facilities for further monitoring. We are also using ESSER funding to improve HVAC systems district-wide. We have a process in place that will alert our DPS Building Services team when negative indoor air quality is present, and we consistently deploy testing and mitigation services. In a facility conditions assessment of 2019, it was determined that DPS had more than $700 million worth of mechanical needs over the last 2 years. That's $700 million. Over the last 2 years, the district has spent more than $15 million on indoor air quality improvements. Our efforts will continue to help reduce sick days, remove mold risk, mitigate asthma and allergy triggers, reduce energy costs, and even improve test scores. Additionally, DPS will undergo a new 2024 facility conditions assessment that will determine our priorities in indoor air quality and other capital improvements. End quote. Now, folks, this is a one-hour program, as we all know, all of our many thousands of listeners. So there are always articles that don't get read. They get shunted aside and eventually are not read, and we never hear them. However, these articles are retained in the Indie Week's website, which is indieweek.com. I'm about to read one of two articles, a shorter one. This is concerning legalization and enforcement of marijuana and hemp laws within the state of North Carolina, amongst other places. And the long article is 8 pages long, and it's the title, and it was written about a month ago, April 19th. At Indy Week, law enforcement officers and the criminal justice system face a quandary in discerning between marijuana and legal hemp. And, of course, this impacts traffic stops, arrests, and various things, which from organization to law enforcement organization across the state, county, even within the city, are prioritized differently and involve different encounters with the law enforcement and justice system. So that article by Michael Hewitt is a very long one. It's worth a read. I, unfortunately, will not have time to read it. That's why I'm encouraging you folks who are interested in any of these things, go to indieweek.com. It's a free publication, a free website. There's no subscription. And they will have a backlog of many, many artistic articles, record reviews, movie reviews, book reviews, and then other public information and articles that I do not have time to read. IndieWeek.com is your source for all this. They've recently upgraded their reportage and systems for getting these articles onto the internet and increasing the frequency of them. That's why my folder is so full each week. So that's all I'll tell you about that one, except to encourage you to go there and see places. For example, the Best of the Triangle Awards, which have just come out of Wake County, restaurants, businesses, they have all of that on their internet presence. All right, so what will I read you? That's enough of what I won't. two stops, this Orange County lawmaker Greg Meyer, who made a campaign video but concerning traffic stops for marijuana. The ad is called Two Stops. And this article goes on, as the U.S. DEA moves to reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug, and state lawmakers grapple with a medical marijuana bill yet again this legislative session, Democratic State Senator Greg Meyer is clear in his belief that cannabis prohibition must end. Meyer, who's running for re-election to represent Orange, Caswell, and Person counties, and previously served four terms in the State House, released a campaign ad last month called Two Stops. It's a fictionalized depiction of the experiences of a white man and a black man, each caught smoking weed by a police officer. The white man ends his day at the golf course while the black man goes to jail. We talked with Mayer about this ad and the status of local laws as the short legislative session gets underway. And this is a Q&A form of article. Tell me about the vision behind this ad. And Meyer replies, I introduced the Marijuana Justice and Reinvestment Act in the last session and did a little bit of PR about it, including a column I ran 2 years ago in the Indy. And I reintroduced it in this year's session. In this session, we actually started to see some traction on Senate Bill 3. That was the medical marijuana bill sponsored by Senator Bill Raybon. I continue to want to put pressure on the legislature to have goals that are not fulfilled by SB 3. We wanted to do an ad that would move beyond the inside political circles to change a public conversation, and we're really happy because we got an ad that went super viral. 4 million views over the weekend of April 20th, including tons of people that would have never seen a straight campaign ad. And the ad is elevating the specifics about racial injustice in marijuana policy, but also elevating having a 5-point standard for legalization, legalizing it, which is related to decriminalization, and then regulating, producing, taxing, and reinvesting it. I want to do so much more to talk about the importance of reinvesting the money we can make off of marijuana into the communities that have been hurt the most by the war on drugs, black communities, poor communities. And we also have the chance, if we really do production well, to make sure that this is an industry that's helpful to rural communities. Question. You said there's traction now around this medical bill. Do you feel like there's traction around recreational legalization or decriminalization? What are you looking to push while working with the Republican supermajority? The medical bill passed the Senate, and it's been stalled in the House, and I don't know what's going to happen with it this session. But there are some reasons why it's just not the best approach. As the bill is written, the program would cost the state $38 million more than it would bring in every year. That just doesn't make any sense, to run a program that can't even pay for itself. And when you talk to folks about marijuana legalization, whether people are a user or not, one of the main things they know is that we should be regulating and taxing it so we can make money off of it. And we probably wouldn't make a lot of money off it. So we should be moving as quickly as we can toward a policy that generates the maximum amount of revenue for the state. And that, I think, requires full legalization. How does your legalization bill compare with what other states have passed? Our bill, he responds, would be the best in the country because it learns from every single state that's come in front of us. And particularly, it would be the best on regulation. We're in a really bad spot today for public health because we essentially have the Wild West in the CBD market, where there's no regulation on CBD products, including THCA. And then we still have an illegal marijuana market. We really have an opportunity here to move to a regulated market that learns the lesson about how to have effective labeling and dosage that can reduce some of the direct harms to people. but also a market that has a lot of controls that will take advantage of the things we've learned about how to reduce alcohol and tobacco abuse and addiction, and how to reduce teen consumption. So, for instance, in my bill, there's a complete prohibition on marketing. This is a product that doesn't need any help. We don't need to have marketing campaigns that are slyly attractive to teenagers. We should do the opposite. We should have money that's spent directly on helping to educate teenagers about why marijuana usage is so damaging to their developing brains. And if we do it right, we can learn from other states. We can also learn from our own past with how we've really developed much better public health habits around tobacco and alcohol. The criticism of sports betting, which was legalized recently, has centered around the big companies coming in to make money at the cost of North Carolinians. I've heard similar worries that legalization in hemp marijuana industry would allow big companies to make money at the cost of citizens. Is that addressed in the bill? That's really about the production and distribution. SB3 has what's called a vertical integration to the market. One company would grow it, produce it, and sell it to you in retail stores. That's the exact opposite of what we do with alcohol, where we have a split market where you cannot be the same company that does any of these three things. In North Carolina, with hard alcohol, we have state distribution. We break up the industry, so you really can't have any monopolies. And I think most North Carolinians want to make sure when we do legalization that we do it in a way that as much of the profit from the industry comes back to North Carolina as possible. If we give these vertical monopolies to large multinational corporations, we're throwing away our chance to make money off this, including for farmers who want to farm it, companies that want to produce it. The one area where I would probably like to see a limit on local investment is nobody wants a Wild West situation with a pot shop on every corner, like you've seen in some of the states that legalized early. We have a great example in the way we do distribution through the state's ABC system of hard alcohol. We end up with some of the highest tax revenues of alcohol of any state and some of the lowest abuse numbers. I would be in favor of a very controlled distribution and retail sales system. But I want North Carolinians to be able to farm, produce, and make money off that side of the industry. You mentioned the Wild West of marijuana products. Does hemp, Delta 8, Delta 10, THCA, all coming into the market over the past few years, put a new urgency behind this? Yes. We've got people walking around the streets right now functionally buying unregulated marijuana products in the form of THCA or other variations. And some of that is going to people who shouldn't be able to use it, like teens. And it leaves an illegal market where we know that the people who are the most likely to be charged and imprisoned for marijuana are black folks. When you have some folks walking around doing it illegally, and some folks still being subjected to disproportionate criminal justice penalties, we need to fix the system. It's not really working for anybody except the retail sales people. Final question. Looking at a map of marijuana policy by state, the South stands out, like we tend to do in a lot of ways. Why is that? Answer, the General Assembly is clearly behind the public willingness. The polling shows that legalization always polls more than 60% favorably, and medical use sometimes 70 to 80. The General Assembly has not been willing to move on this because Republicans haven't been willing to move on this. Democrats need to make this a campaign issue because we have a clear distinction here. We understand it's inevitable. And we're willing to address it today and come up with standards that are good for North Carolina rather than setting up another corporation to extract money from North Carolina. We should be talking about this as something we're going to deliver for people. The public's talking about it. People talking about marijuana usage everywhere, including people that don't use it. We're not in an era where it's only potheads are saying we should legalize it. all kinds of people want to legalize it for all kinds of reasons. People understand the logic of why we should legalize it at this point. Well, now, on my 8 remaining minutes, I can spend some time on some arts in the area. And first is a review just at the end of last month by Brian Howe of a release called Reverse Bloom, a self-released recording by Emma Geiger, her second released. And he gives it 4 stars. And the article is short, and here it goes. Emma Geiger, who moved to Durham from Los Angeles several years ago, is a singer-songwriter with a plain-spoken but artfully decorated style and a clear, serene voice. She has described the title song on her second release, Reverse Bloom, as a sort of platonic breakup ballad. It exemplifies how to express heavy feelings with the lightest of touches. Opening song, All Your Words, sets a slow autumnal mood in the manner of Azure Ray, though the glamorous golden age Hollywood strings that keep sweeping in are distinctly more Lana Del Rey, which is characteristic of the musical surprises embedded in these intimate songs. Geiger sings, how do I move through myself and into something good? She's as judicious a lyricist as she is a musician, and she goes on to answer herself throughout the record. Reverse Bloom is hypnotic without being insensate, ethereal, yet precise, and has a winning naturalness and simplicity, as the video for Vines, which finds Geiger touching grass and trees in a coastal field, attests. In addition to her acoustic guitar and synths, the band includes drummer Joe Westerlund, violinist Emma Kelly, and co-producer Connor Whelan, among other contributors who sensitively shaped the song at Betty's in Chapel Hill. With the song Empty, Durham multi-instrumentalist Michael Grigoni's pedal steel starts trailing Geiger like footprints over a hilly UK folk song, and her voice begins to braid together with Archer Boyette's, their timbres so well matched you might guess that Geiger is harmonizing with herself. Invite You begins in strummed simplicity, but ends as a cockeyed 90s indie groove like Mary Timony with less tude, or Slant 6 with more chops. As for the answer to that trick, to that question in All Your Words, perhaps it comes most clearly in the great opening line of the title track, You Break the Silence with a Song. Fitting alongside the likes of Grouper and Laura Veyers, as well as local talents like Skylar Goodage and Chessa Rich, this concise, grounded dream pop record is notably lucid take on the style, one that justly reflects the sudden pivots and strange contrasts of a person's relatable yet unknowable emotional life. Review by Brian Howe of Emma Geiger, self-released recording called Reverse Bloom. Now, I will take as much time as I have to begin a long interview with the author Colm Tóibín. That's T-O-I-B-I-N, Colm, first word, C-O-L-M, Colm Tóibín, about a sequel to his novel Brooklyn. And this, he will come to North Carolina, to Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, on May the 10th, on a tour. It's his latest North Carolina, first time this month, on a tour for his latest long novel, Long Island. That's a sequel to his 2009 beloved blockbuster, Brooklyn, the first of the two books, one of the many that Tóibín, a literature professor at Columbia and prolific critic and journalist, has written, follows Ellis Lacey, a young immigrant in the 1950s, torn between Ireland and her new titular home. Long Island picks up the thread many years later when Ellis, now a mother of two children, receives the sudden news within the first few pages that her husband has gotten another woman pregnant and that her family is expected to take the child in. From there, Ellis returns to Ireland on a visit where she again finds herself painfully suspended between two worlds. As she reconnects with childhood friend Nancy Sheridan, old flame Jim Farrell, and is confronted with old choices. Toyben is a great writer of silence, and this sequel, like much of his work, is an exercise in restraint, with what is left unsaid on the page mirroring the omissions and half-truths of his characters' lives. And ahead of the May 10th visit to Quail Ridge, the Indie spoke with Toyben about the novel, the similitude between Southern and Irish culture, and student anti-war protests. And this is a four-page interview, and I have almost zero time to talk about it, and just reinforce the idea that perhaps a visit to Quail Ridge Books website and to see this event is for May the 10th at 7 p.m., and Colin Toyben's book selling. He may be talking about it. There may be book signings, and I would suggest you go there to Quail Ridge Books and find out if it's even available to go to. And in any event, as I mentioned before, IndieWeek.com has the complete interview with this author. And as the same token, I will talk about Southern Futures Festival, which just came to an end May 3rd through 5th, and it happened, The Commons was the title of it, and there was a long article last weekend about community members, artists, and how to adjust your vision to include the people the six artists will bring forth in their works on that weekend. And again, that's an article by Brian Woods in IndieWeek.com. And finally, Bury Me at the Casa Bacardi, and that was dispatches from the 2024 Dreamville Festival that also took place just recently. And it's a longish article, and you can find that on IndieWeek.com. I seem to be saying that a lot, but really, folks, this is a good publication. And John Feddersen, your reader, gets more out of it than just reading the words. I wish there were more time, but I don't have any more. You can find this particular issue with me reading online at ncreadingservice.org. So thanks very much, and we'll be with you next week.